This episode is sponsored by W Lloyd Services. For all building and landscaping works across the southeast of England, they offer quality services at quality prices. If, like me, the thought of painting your eyelids shut is more appealing than fixing up the house yourself, it's professionals like W Lloyd Services who you need when it comes to home and office improvements or building from scratch. Call 07949 380 775 for your building and landscaping needs. Good evening, thank you very much. I had to ask Brian to do that because, you know, if you've got the voice out there, then you've got to do it. But anyway, welcome to the Real Feedback Podcast. This is episode 96 of the Real Feedback Podcast. And welcome to the Prince Charles Cinema, which hallowed ground for cinephiles. But this stage has seen names such as Quentin Tarantino, Kevin Smith, Jackie Chan and Harrison Ford, although I'd like to point out that none of them have climbed Everest three times. Like, and just in case anyone doesn't realise I'm not talking about myself, obviously I'm talking about the great man, Mr. Blessed. I don't think I've even climbed the steps at Covent Garden Tube three times. But anyway, a little bit of a Prince Charles Cinema fact for you. It was a porn theatre back in the day, so maybe a few interesting things have happened in this room. Who's sitting in G2? Yeah, there's some Ajax and a J-cloth under the seat there for you. And in front and behind, as you know. Okay, so tonight we were going to have an interval in the middle. So apologies to the alcoholics in the room, but that is no longer happening because we're just going to go straight through with Brian. There will be a Q&A at the end, as you know. I'm not going to give you the spiel on the podcast, but if you want to grab that QR code and listen to some other episodes, that would be very most welcome. But for now, he is Blackadder's dad. He is Robin Hood's dad. He has punched Harold Pinter and a polar bear in the face, not on the same night. He is a legend. He is here. He is Brian Blessed. How are you, sir?
Hello. Yes, I'm sorry. I'm technically brilliant. That's why I've got all fucking snarled up. Well, it's nice to see you. To see you, nice. Gosh, here I'm in the West End. Who the fuck are you? Scared the fucking life out of me. There's one thing I must say. Gordon's alive! Now, everywhere, ladies and gentlemen, everywhere I go, I'm glad you're here on this night, tonight. I very rarely come in the West End, but it's everywhere I go. I actually went to the magnetic North Pole not so long ago. I'm the oldest man to reach it. No end to my talents. It's worth a round. There we go. Anyway. So I went to the North Pole, a British expedition, and about 20 miles before we got, when you get there, your hair stands on end. Absolutely amazing. We went from Resolute in Canada, about 4 or 5 months, eventually we got there. In the meantime, I saved a polar bear's life, if you've probably heard about that. It came into our tent one night. People had guns. I wouldn't let them shoot it because it's its territory after all. And so when it came in the tent, it said, I just hit it straight on the nose. Rah! Bang! Fuck! And it went, ooh, ooh, ooh. And it ran away. And I saved its life. And that's But about 20 miles from the pole, I heard this humming sound. And it's only about 4 feet thick, that area, and we were all pretty exhausted. And a conning tower came through the ice, and it was a Russian Typhoon submarine, very like Red October, with Sean Connery. And out got the captain, he saw me, and he went, oh, it's him. Please say Gordon's alive. So, Gordon's alive! I said, thank you very much. Please come on board. And I went on board the submarine and I sang the Volga Boatman. Yo heave ho, yo ho ho ho, yo heave ho, yo heave ho. That's worth another round. Anyway.
Your hands are going to be very sore by the end of the night.
But whenever I go in the world, people want me to say, Gordon, sir, I think it is. I'm going to let you talk in a second.
That's no problem. Now you carry on.
I think it's a kind of battle cry for a celebration of freedom, of happiness. We need lots of that these days, don't we? And therefore, people just love it as a great expression. I have to say, I'm going to talk a little bit about Flash Gordon, all right?
Well,
I get, you know, they often say the film is camp. That's bollocks. I mean, it is a great film. It's got great music, marvellous actors, colour, design, everything. It is quite sensational. When you see people flying in films, it's always special effects or this, that, and the other. But in our Flash Gordon, in that film, you've got between 2,500 to 4,000 people, my people, flying, actually flying with their wings and wires. You know, amazing, astonishing, and it's an amazing sequence. There is a sequence. We attack rocket ship Ajax. You know, and we're all lined up there, about 2,500, 3,000 people, all getting ready, taking bloody ages to do it. And I'm in charge. I organize the whole scene with all the Hawkmen and so forth, and Flash alongside me. There it was, and I said, "Stand by, my Hawkmen! Ready, Flash! Dive!" No. I have to tell you, at that point, I'm carrying what looks like an old parrot. It's a cudgel that I hit people with, you know, and I've got that. And so forth. So I said, dive! And the manager said to me, Brian, and as we got there, I said, dive. And he said, Brian, I made the noise of all the Hawkmen. He said, Brian, we put in the special effects, not you. I didn't tell that story right at all. But it was an amazing scene, and I choreographed all the fighting and everything else in it. But I think that the whole film is absolutely sensational. But I've been all over the world, Kilimanjaro and Africa and other countries, and they all want me to say, Gordon's alive. Wherever I go, it's him, Watusi. Please say Gordon's alive. Gordon's alive! And they just love it. It's amazing. Whenever I go.
Has there ever been a week where you haven't had to say it?
No. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, wherever I go, people want me to say Gordon's alive. Yes, yes. It's amazing. There's only one thing that rivals it, and that's me as in Peppa Pig. I'm Peppa Pig, of course. I'm Grampy Rabbit. And when I got, you know, it's amazing, isn't it? I've always been very lucky. But I mean, do you realize that Peppa Pig is the biggest hit in the world? The Chinese have bought it for £14 billion. Fucking hell! The fucking Chinese have bought it for all that fucking money! It's fucking astonishing! And I'm Grampy Rabbit. And I have my little lighthouse, and people come along with their ships and so forth. They come along. When anyone's in trouble, then I shout. All the lights go off. So how do I save their lives on their ships? I shout, fog! And that saves their life. Sorry, I must give you a fucking artifact. And I say, fog! And all the kids, they all want me to say fog whenever I get little children, etc. I was at a school not so long ago, and there's a little girl about that big. And she stepped forward. She was the captain of the infant school. And she said, "We have got Brian Blessed here from Flash Gordon. Gordon's alive." Ha ha. The sweet. Gordon's alive. Ha ha. It's the sweetest thing. Never what a daft story. I'll let you start me over,
well,
son.
I've now got a problem with the order of my slides, but, you know, that's absolutely fine. never mind. So let's go back to early day. Your first television appearance,
yes,
which was Zed Cars.
Yes.
Fancy Smith.
Yes, it's strange, ladies and gentlemen. I've not usually been interviewed. I usually kind of speak on my own all the time. But I was at the Bristol Vic Theatre School, leading into Zed Cars. And I'm a coal miner's son. My dad was a coal hewer, and I was born in Mexborough and lived in Goldthorpe, Patrick Stewart in the next village, and Judy Dench, and so forth. Very poor. My dad was gassed 3 times and crushed 3 times. I mean, amazing kind of days that my dad could survive all that. But they were astonishing. And, of course, Flash Gordon was on in the cinemas nearby, black and white, with Buster Crabbe. Very, very successful. And Patrick Stewart and I, he always talked like that even then, you know, Brian. And he was losing his hair even then. And he was only 11 years of age. I'm going fucking bald, Brian. You're not going bald. Stop fucking with Brian, Brian, I am. I said, no, you're not well, that's all. And I went to his house to see him. And there were his parents, and there was his dad, and there was his 2 brothers, and they were all bald. So, I'm sorry, mate, you're going to be fucking bald. And he had 1 strand, and I fucking cut it with some garden shears. Anyway, why did I mention that? Goldthorpe. I was born in Mexborough. And we had wonderful radio. Dick Bounce, Special Agent, Paul Temple, The War of the Worlds, you name it. There were exciting times in Yorkshire. Wonderful, the war years. And so forth. Absolutely sensational. And Patrick and I dreamt of being actors. It was impossible. It was impossible for us to be actors. We're coal miners' sons. And we did amateur theatre, and we watched amateur theatre, and this, that, and the other. But we dreamt of professional theatre. You know, we went on drama courses and things like that. The Calder Valley in South Yorkshire. Ah. Oh. And eventually, we got a scholarship each. Astonishing. I mean, that day. And long story short, I had to do my national service. I'd got a scholarship, but Patrick did not do national service. I don't know why, but I had to. I was in the parachute regiment. And once I'd finished that, then I could go to drama school. I'd set my heart on the Bristol Vic School. This wonderful old Vic school, and so forth. I wanted to go there, and so forth, and so did Patrick. Patrick and I, we dreamt of seeing professional theatre. And here you are in the West End. You know, it's wonderful and exciting. But Patrick and I had never seen any theatre. We went to Sheffield and saw a lovely production there, the cathedral, Hugh Walpole, all blue and green, the cathedral, and great actors. Oh, it was absolutely sensational. We couldn't believe it. And let me go from here. I then went to, I'm leading up to your question eventually. I kind of went to the Bristol Vic Theatre School, and what was wonderful was, because I was a coal miner's son with a C-class education in a secondary school, and I passed all the exams. They loved me. Top professional teachers. Because the Bristol Vic had the Old Vic Theatre, you had the university, and you had the school. Now, we were there as students, but we weren't allowed to mix with the professional actors, etc. And at that time, I have to tell you that... in the whole of my life, come with me.
Yes, yes, I will.
In the whole of my life, I've kind of never seen at that particular time an actor who was so brilliant as Peter O'Toole. He was in the Bristol Vic Company. It was fucking sensational. It's Hamlet. He would race around the theatre. We saw the dress rehearsals as students. He'd race around the theatre, climb up to the top and into the balcony. He'd come and sit on people's knees. I'm going to give you the next fucking soliloquy. A lovely one. Listen to it. It's fucking marvellous. And he would sit on somebody's knee. I've never seen such an exciting, brilliant, imaginative actor. But we couldn't mix with them. Anyway, at school, I was in a play called House of Regrets at the university. O'Toole was in the audience. And he came backstage and said, "Hello, my name is Peter O'Toole." I said, "I'm Brian Blake." "Yeah, yeah. I've watched you. You work from strength. I work from fragility. Tonight, you were fragile. That was fucking marvelous." "What's your name again?" I said, "Brian Blessed." "Parachute command?" "Yes. I was in the Navy." "Is that a fucking threat?" "What the fuck?" "I have to tell you that I was schoolboy boxing champion. It was the beginning of him and me doing physical tests all the time. Peter O'Toole in Bristol and so forth. And one day he challenged me to a race. I was not as heavy as I am now. A race with him in Bristol at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we ran across the common there over the suspension bridge into the woods at great speed. People timing it. 3 o'clock in the morning, running like fuck. Then we came back again to the suspension bridge. He was a bit pissed, so he got a bit tired. We got over the suspension bridge, got to the other side, and there were two professors, Professor Brown and Laidlaw. And they were crying their eyes out. And we said, "What's the matter?" "Oh, we've just been to see Sir John Gielgud in The Seven Ages of Man." "Oh, the heart stops. He has such a phenomenal grasp of the verse. Wonderful, wonderful. You must go and see him. You must go and see him. You must go and see him." And they cried their eyes out and they fucked off. And O'Toole looked at me and said, "It's amazing. It's amazing, isn't it, Brian? They're so enamored of Sir John Gielgud, they fail to realize that both you and I are bollock naked." And you could do that in those days. It was the start of a fucking amazing relationship I had with O'Toole over the fucking years. Yeah. I mean, people like Richard Harris and other wild guy, a wild guy in Gladiator. What? Oliver Reed. Oh, I used to knock fuck out of him. But O'Toole was sinewy and amazing. We had many fights. I always fucking won and so forth. He's amazing. He lasted as long as he did. And I'll let you talk.
I'm going to cut in now.
For fuck's sake, shut up.
That's why my intro was so long, because I thought, yeah, that's the most I'll speak. Okay. So Zed cars.
Oh, Zed.
let me ask an actual question.
He's very, very
Zed cars was alive, yes?
He's very, very understanding. Now, so I was at the school. I then left drama school, and we dreamt. And I got ASM and small parts at Nottingham Rep. Nottingham Rep then was Valmet and all that. Lovely cast and people. And I got £4.19 and 6 a week. And I built the fucking sets. It was astonishing. And a marvellous theatre, the old ancient playhouse in Nottingham. And won all kinds of awards, and are seen by Sir Barry Jackson. By the way, one day at the... Yes, I will. I won't make it too fucking long. I get terrible fucking wind. I'm sorry. I was at the Nottingham Rep. Is he upstaging me, the fucker?
I don't think I am, no.
Don't you fucking dare. It's my fucking show. So fucking sick of it. So anyway, I was at Nottingham Rep. And at the stage door one day, this woman with great broad shoulders and a great big dress, and said, "Oh, hello, I've always loved this theatre. I've always wanted to come in to see it. I've got a play on, you know, nearby. Oh, my name is Agatha Christie." I said, "Oh, you're Agatha Christie." And we became great friends. All over Nottingham together, you know, and flirting with her and all kinds of marvellous, wonderful lady. So you could expect that at any time. But I've always been bad with wood. As I said, I was a salmon, small parts. Keep following me.
Trying.
No, salmon, small parts. I got leads in as well, eventually. Anyway, one day a guy appeared at the stage door. Now, I was stage, it was only went as far as that, and there was the street. You're in the fucking street. And people would often pop in. That side, it was big, the wings. But over there, it was very tight. And so forth. And as I said, all the time, people popped in. I remember I was doing Peer Gynt. And a Peer Gynt, really difficult part. I played him. Of course, he's young to begin with, then he's middle-aged, and then he gets very, very old. So at the end, I just was shrunk at this Peer Gynt. Most wonderful, sensitive performance. And suddenly the door opened over there. The guy walked in and said, "Excuse me, could you tell me the way to Mapley Road?" I said, "Yeah, yes, look, just go up that road there, turn left, turn right." And you never knew. You could be doing an Agatha Christie. I mean, one guy one day raced across the stage, moved across and said, "You're all poofs!" And then ran off. So you never knew what the fuck was going to happen. Anyway, one day a guy came to the stage door and he said, hello, I've always wanted to work backstage. I've just come out of the army, I'm a captain. I've got plenty of money, I don't need to be paid. I said, "Well, you have to be paid £1. That's equity ruling." "All right." And he was there. I said, "Are you any good with wood?" "Oh, yeah." And he was. And because when I made doors, they never fucking fitted. Actors couldn't get off the stage. "I can't get off, Brad. I can't fucking get off." And they used to exit through the chimney. Anyway. So this guy came in, and he was good with wood. It was, and anyway, halfway through the season, I thought, well, I'll... He obviously couldn't act. He drew a line, and the universe stopped. You thought the whole audience will cut their fucking throats. It was so fucking dreadful. And I said, "I'm going to teach you a bit of acting. I'm going to get you an audition. Because you can't act. I'll teach you an opening speech from Henry V. Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the brightest heaven of invention. I'll teach you that. And then a simple from a Yorkshire piece as well, because you've got a Yorkshire accent. But don't move. You mustn't move your body, because they'll know you can't fucking act. Don't move at all, love. At fucking all." It's a good note. Don't fucking move. You can do the hope of abusing there, and you can be very good indeed, and no one can criticise you. Anyway, I taught him these fucking speeches, and we got him an audition at Oldham Rep. And he phoned me through that evening and said, "Hello, oh, Brian, shit, said, what's the matter? Oh, I've got the part." I said, "Oh, fucking hell." I said, "Anyway, it's only for one play, and I'm playing myself." And that night, Granada Television were in, and they saw him, and they gave him a job in Coronation Street. Bill Roach. So every time I see him, "Bill, don't move, or they know you can't fucking act, you fuck up! Fuck up, you cunt!" It's your question now, love.
Question two. No. Let's move on from Zed Cars.
Oh, Zed Cars! There we are. Now, shut up for a moment. Driving us up the fucking wall. So, what I want to say is, my wife said, "You won't swear, will you?" I'm not going to. Of course, I won't. I did different reps. I became leading actor at Birmingham Rep with Sir Barry Jackson, played King Lear at 21 years of age, and things like this. It was kind of astonishing at the time. And I came down to London because I'd just finished with Birmingham Rep. And the whole of London, like it is now, is beetling with people and so and aspirations. And it was at the Wyndham Theatre that it was said the great Orson Welles was there. He was doing Citizen Kane and all these great, the Third Man and all these great films. This astonishing, amazing talent. Orson Welles. And I rushed to the theatre, and there were hundreds of actors in rows. And I got right to the front because I knew the stage manager. Can you get me an interview? Can you get me an interview with Orson Welles? And I went, yeah, yeah. I went on the stage. It was dark. I could see a man in a white suit, gigantic guy with shoulders.
Yes. What have you got for me?
I said, well, I'm going to do you Aaron from Titus Andronicus, the great black warrior, Aaron. He said, well, thank fuck for that. I've been listening to Romeos and all that and Hamlets and Richard II all fucking day. The next person I said who comes on and gives me Hamlet, I'll fuck him personally. And you won't read that about Orson Welles in the newspapers at all. Anyway, I did Aaron. He adored it. He then offered me Hotspur in Chimes at Midnight, but eventually I wasn't free to play it. Oh, it would have been great being with Orson Welles. But then at that particular time, they were doing a semi-documentary series called Z Cars. Now, look. Please don't encourage him. I have to remind you that I am the fucking star. Posh fucking blue suit, and I look a cunt. Fucking hell. My wife said, one word you must not say, and that's cunt. And I won't. I fucking won't. So, anyway, Television Centre was a great place. Down the road in those days, you know, we had Forsyth Saga, I Claudius Venture, because I was in there, all kinds of little Three Musketeers, God knows what. But they were planning a series called Z-Cars. And I'll tell you now, ladies and gentlemen, that Z-Cars at its best is the greatest television ever created. It was live. Everybody wanted to be in it. Film stars, everybody. And it was 50 minutes live and 5 minutes filmed. And we had the cars in the studio, and special effects at Television Centre. It could drop different levels and this, that, and the other. And I went on to meet David Rose. And I was reading for the Norwegian Gunner in episode 5. I read for it, and they said, would you mind just leaving for a second? Okay. Would you come back in again? We'd like you to read for a character called Francis Smith, who is the lead, a kind of heroic policeman in the Z-Car. He's tough, he's sensitive, as this, that, and the other. And he's described as being long and thin with Italian clothes. I said, well, that rules me out, and so forth. No, no, no. But you read it, and what comes out is that you fancy yourself in a different way. You fancy being tough. You come over as incredibly tough, like Brando. We'd like you to play Francis Smith. And I did. I mean, we got between 30 to 50 million viewers a week, live. I couldn't go anywhere. We were more famous than the Beatles, we really were. I couldn't go shopping. I couldn't go anywhere. It was a great, great part. And they wrote marvelous scripts for me. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful scripts and so forth. And it was the beginning of a kind of where I started to be well known, et cetera, et cetera. I was known as a classical actor. But here I was as Francis Smith. Come here. Come here. I'll knock your bloody head off. Come here. Don't you cross me. Don't you dare cross me. Come here. And everyone, they loved it and so forth. And I followed it
I just
up.
Shit myself, Ryan, then.
And so don't feel threatened. And then, of course, near the end of it, they cast me, it was unbelievable, as Porthos in The Three Musketeers, the BBC. Jeremy Brett as D'Artagnan, etc. And I played this flamboyant musketeer in orange and red and curls, who's a brilliant swordsman. I did years and years of swordsmanship. You can see it. The wrist. And I was Porthos from being being Fancy Smith and being like this. And that was Porthos! And so forth. And I had a wonderful following with the ladies, with my curly hair and curls and white horse. And so what I'm saying is, I did all that rep and people helped me. We all need help. This Gordon's Alive is interesting. In advice, you ladies and gentlemen, and thanks for being here tonight, I think apart from your ability as an artist, you've got to have a gimmick. You've got to find a gimmick that suits you. Who are you? Who are you? I mean, what's your first name? Yeah.
David.
What?
David.
David. But are you really David? We are being esoteric now. Is an elephant really an elephant? A rhinoceros? Is that their real name? Gorilla? Chimpanzee? Brian? Is that my real name? Who are we? I'm deviating slightly. Where was I? Where the fuck was I?
Well,
what?
We're Zed cars, but I want, just before we finish Zed cars, I wanted to tell you, this is a quote from your book, Absolute Pandemonium, which I highly recommend the audiobook. I've heard it twice. This is the line regarding your fame from Zed cars that nearly made me crash. You did a celebrity football match and they let the fans come on at the end. Oh. And in your book, you said, and they were obviously quite rough and physical with you. And in your book, you said, how I've still got a penis, I'll never know. That poor thing was yanked more times than I've had hot dinners. Amazing.
I was, wait, you see, gimmick, hold on to gimmick. And so, we used to play amateur professional football with Tottenham Hotspur and Arsenal and all the others. We'd join in for charity on the odd weekend, and I was playing centre forward. I always got 8 goals offside. I'd have half the England team marking me, but they'd let me get offside, or they'd foul me, and I'd fall down in the penalty area and get a fucking penalty. And the audiences came to see this. On one occasion, it was periodically, I had to knock out Henry Cooper, the British and Empire and European heavyweight champion. He'd foul me, then I'd fucking hit him. And he had a big bag of blood, which he'd put in his mouth, and it'd fall. And the blood would run down his chest, and they'd carry him off. Brian Blessed Fancy Smith has knocked out Henry Cooper! The referee would send me off. It was a big act. But I had to score lots and lots and lots of goals. I met Muhammad Ali, it was Cassius Clay, because we were at Television Centre, and he was fighting Henry Cooper at White City. And I'd done a lot of boxing, and he loved all that, and I had great knowledge of boxers and their records, particularly the heavyweights, and so forth. And we talked about it a great deal. And he said, you know, I'm going to meet Henry again. He's going to give me a lot of trouble, he said, but I'll have to be very careful with him. When I first started, Brian, Muhammad Ali said, Cassius Clay, I used to win all my fights well, but nobody came to see me. Bear this in mind. Nobody came to see him. He said, nobody at all. He said, I'd win a fight, but that was it. You know, Cassius Clay wins again. And I was in despair, he said. And I went to a circus in New York. And a man approached the circus, a big fat man, with some weights that were plastic and balloons. And he got a robe on, and on the back of the robe it said, I am the greatest. He said, that's it! That's it! I'll say I'm the greatest. Great. And I've never looked back, Brian. So, of course, we selected people I knew I could beat easily, but then eventually I became so good that I could actually beat anybody I wanted and so forth. But the term the greatest, it was, you know, that was it. That's what he was remembered for, being the greatest and so forth. I don't know why I told that. Anyway, I sparred with him. It was great, great, great fun and so forth.
With Muhammad Ali? You sparred with
him. Yeah. Oh, it's lovely. It's sweet. Yes, it was sweet and sweet. And people watching, you know, after about two rounds of it, then I'd hit him to the body and then a right cross high in his head and he'd go down and take the full count. It was absolutely fucking lovely. People thought he'd been fucking knocked out. I'm not... He hit me so hard, my relatives could, you know, could feel it in Jamaica, he said. He's a lovely man, lovely man. But I've always loved boxing. But anyway, there it was. I was in Z-cars. But the BBC always took care of me. They always... You're very understanding, by the way, aren't you? If I was gay, I'd love you. But I'm not fucking gay. Most of my friends are gay, but I'm not, anyway. Well, but you can pass that on if you want, if you don't believe it. Inquire about my sexual prowess. I want to say sexually. Of course, my career, I'm 50% actor, and I'm 50% explorer. And so I've been all over the world. I've been on expeditions here and expeditions there, etc. And I've worked with so many animals, but I particularly work with gorillas. Over in Kent, many, many years ago, at Aspinall's place, he had a gorilla there called Gurgis, and so forth. And Gurgis was 48 stone, 45 stone, incredibly broad, 6'3". They're normally about 6 feet, bull gorillas. Maybe 6'3", huge. And I used to wrestle him all the time. I'd go meet him and wrestle him and tickle him. And he adored me. And if he got a bit too heavy with me, I used to grab his cock. And he would, gorillas laugh.
You sure he was laughing?
I got your cock! I don't think Attenborough ever did that. Yeah, no. But all the female gorillas would fucking come to help me. And these female gorillas are all passive. Oh, they're lovely. And they would sit around me, Zuma, one of them. She sat around me with my flies and all that. And they'd sit and look at me. And he's me now. And she's there. And their fucking hands would come out. So I promise I'm not going to grab it. And the fucking hands would come out. And they'd try and grab my cock. It's a universal language. She'd move away, and then eventually I would come the hand. And you just love to grab my cock. They are incredibly, incredibly sexy. But there's Gurdjieff. Bear this in mind, young men. There's Gurdjieff, 6'3", a 48 fucking stone, love, and his dick is a little licorice that big. How is it possible, God, that you forgot to give him a cock? It's beyond me how gorillas have only got little lipsticks. I thought I've mentioned that before in an interview. But I do a tremendous amount of work with animals all over the world. I had a very dear orangutan that was very close to me for dozens and dozens of years. I fought for his freedom, and I failed. This wonderful orangutan won. He adored me. He became so depressed and passed away. He was at the Chessington Zoo at the time. I tried to get him free to send him, but I've done lots of work with them, mainly in Malaysia and so forth. And therefore, I am 50% actor and 50% explorer. I am a BBC man. The BBC created me. I listened to the radios as a child, BBC Light Programme, BBC Home Service. I then went eventually to Television Centre, which was a miraculous place, you know. And those are wonderful days. You've got Mount Eros there at Television Centre. It goes up, there's a great big fountain with Eros on the top. And one day, Hugh Weldon and other director generals and all kinds gathered around me after I'd done an episode of Z-Cars and I'd been mountaineer and all that, and they said, well... They said, Brian, you can climb. Now we want you to climb up Eros. You've seen Eros there. It's fucking steep. And, you know, I'm an 18-stone man. So I fucking grabbed it and I went to the top, and Hugh Weldon said, "Very good, Brian, very good indeed. This is 12 o'clock at night. Now take it out." And I took out my French letter, my condom, blew it up like a balloon, and tied it onto the cock of Eros at Television Centre. And the Director General said, "Very good. Now I hope people look at the fucking thing." Now, you wouldn't get that these days, would you? You wouldn't. They don't have that same sense of fucking humour as they had. I've never mentioned that before. Anyway, I climbed up the fucker and put it on the French. By the way, as regards French letters and regards expeditions, I've been to South America and been all over. I've climbed the Lost World exists. As a child, I'd heard it on the radio, seen it in films. I thought, it's one part I should have played. It's Professor Challenger. I am Challenger. They can't fucking play it. He should look like you and me. He should be fucking a Syrian bull. Anyway, one of my great adventures, of course, I went to Venezuela. I did the Lost World and went all over it and swam rivers and et cetera. I remember I'd just been cast in as Tarzan by Disney in the animated film Tarzan as the villain Clayton. You know, I'll tell you about Clayton in a second. But then I was in Venezuela. We finished our expedition, etc. An amazing Guiana, and there was Venezuela, and we'd finished it, and we climbed the Lost World. And we got in a pilotless plane and seated our 12-man expedition. We set off from Horsha Falls. It went up. And after 2 hours, I noticed propellers weren't working. It was a new aeroplane. I said to the guy in front, Nick, hey there, Nick, brother. Nick, that fucking propeller's stopping. And the other one too. I was in the RAF. Got my wing. 57 parachute jumps. That's worth a round. And there I was in this pilotus. And I said to the pilot, and he would go, mayday. I said, steer down, head towards, go back, don't go to Caracas, we'll blow up. Head back towards the jungles, find a lake, crash in the lake. Take the other propeller off and glide it in. And we did. 100 miles an hour hitting the treetops into it. Oh, and we survived. Amazing. After about 11 days in the jungle, we got out of the jungle, got to Caracas, and we got back home. And, of course, I had to fulfill my contract in Tarzan. I'm Clayton, you know, the evil Clayton, you know, the one who shoots the gorillas and all that. Horrible bastard, you know. I mean, Disney, by the way, are lovely people. I went to be auditioned for Clayton, and it really is tough with Disney. And there were top stars there, big film stars were there, they're all pissing themselves with laughter at my interpretation because I'd come back from Venezuela and didn't know where the fucking hell I was. And so forth. And I was reading Clayton, this explorer, and making all the sounds. And the Disney people think, fuck. What the fuck this? And who was Hannibal Lecter? What's his name?
Anthony Hopkins.
Anthony Hopkins was there. It's the closest I've been to death. I fell off my chair so many times that I'd never heard a reading like it as Clayton. But of course, I was making all the jungle noises. Anyway, weeks later, Disney phoned up and said, "We thought you were great. We're offering you Clayton." So I went over there after this crash in the forests of Venezuela. Worked on Tarzan. It were all very successful, and I was leaving. And then the part of Clayton is played by Golden, who is the villain in Ghost. And he is the voice of Tarzan. And it's a rather soft voice. Hello. Hello there. Hello, Jane. You would never have cast him. And he's perfect. As Tarzan. Hello. 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 Hello, Clayton.
And I was like this. Very much an aggressive, pompous, frightening 8-foot man. You could see it in the Disney thing. And it was all filmed and finished. And I was leaving. And I could hear in the background this voice of the guy playing Tarzan, Golden. I said, what's going on to Roy Disney? He said, oh, fuck it, O'Brien. He can't do the fucking yodel. Nobody can do the fucking yodel. I said, what did you do? When I was a kid, we went to the cinema house and the picture house and we saw Johnny Weissmuller in Tarzan. And you're doing the yodel all the time. When he entered, he'd come on with an elephant and we'd all shout, Angola! And then we'd go... There you are. And so I did Tarzan. They gave me a fucking extra contract for the fucking yodel. They gave me a fucking contract for the fucking yodel. And when we did the first night in New York, I stood behind him, Jeff, as Tarzan, with a microphone and would yodel into the microphone. And nobody fucking knew it was me. Oh, here's the bad things that I have done. Oh, these bad. By the way, when the Queen gave me the OB, no. Aren't I fucking sensational? I was with her for about 5 or 10 fucking minutes. People said, what on earth did you talk about? She said, you know, I believe you imitate me all the time. I said, no, I don't. She said, you're such a liar. And that's what she said. You're such a liar. And so, yes, she did that. I do miss her. Well, you know, my husband and I would like it to be known. You know, it was wonderful. I mustn't know. She's passed on now. I have to say that, of course, one of my most outrageous performances was not the 9 o'clock news. Remember? Branner, Hopkins, different people. Tom Huddleston writes, apparently, when I'm depressed, when I'm down, I play Brian Blessed in not the 9 o'clock fucking news. I mean, it's the most outrageous thing. Because actors are scared that, you know, I, of course, am not just an actor, which helped. And I'd stood on the chair, jumped on the chair. There was Lord Young. I thought, well, what am I going to say as the chairman? And Lord Young, I remember saying, oh, hello, Mr. Blessed. Yeah, they're very good. I'm glad to be on this panel. Of course, I've always wanted to be an actor. You know, of course, I'm gay. And, well, that doesn't mean a fucking thing. What does gay mean? We're all fucking gay. I mean, what does gay mean? And I turned it into prejudice. You're gay? I didn't know you were fucking gay. Did you? Paul, did you know he was gay? No, I didn't. Did you know he was fucking gay? No, I didn't know he was gay. Fuck it. If I'd have fucking known this, I'd have knocked you straight through that fucking wall. Don't you say another fucking word. And it was, I set off. I jumped on the table. I talked shite. The audience were cheering. And there was a note came through the Conservative Party, said, we're all depressed. Dear Brian, to do something, for Christ's sake, it's just the man that our Prime Minister has died and the burial has cost 40 million quid for Mrs. Thatcher. You know, I said, here's something new for you. So I said, Brian, Mrs. Thatcher, it's cost 40 million quid to fucking, I'm sweating like it, to bury her. Make a coffin and fucking 40 million quid at Westminster Abbey and all this, that, and the other. I said, I used to be an undertaker. I was an undertaker's son. When I left school, secondary school, I helped to make coffins. I said, it's nothing to it.
sawdust and the robes and sanding it and all this and the other. What I would do with her is take her out of the fucking coffin, make a coffin, just need to be cardboard, paint it blue, put her inside, put lots of fucking sawdust in it, strip her off, play with her tits, press her tits, keep pressing her fucking tits until all the gas has come out of her ass. Make her fart a lot. Make her fart and fart and fart. And then tickle her ass. And so all the gas will fucking come down. Squash her tits so she belches and fucking belches. Then paint the fucking thing light blue. Put a fucking lid on it. Put it on a horse and cart. Only cost £10. And I did that on not the 9 o'clock news. My wife said, I could not believe what I was watching. But Tom Hiddleston, I did two of them. I did one later, in which I insulted the entire Chinese government and North Korea and threatened to beat them all up and knock the shit out of them and this, that and the other, and so forth, which apparently the Chinese premier loved. By the way, I want to say something.
So do I.
Oh, look. Now look at the world at the moment. We've got China threatening. Don't threaten that island. Formosa, Taiwan. It's a fucking mountain there that's not been climbed. I was just about ready to fucking climb. It's only 15,000 feet. But fuck me, you can't go in now because they're going to stop me fucking climbing it. For fuck's sake. Fucking twats. I was doing Tom Jones on BBC television. I was Squire Western, the huge queer ritual. They mentioned the House of Commons. Put it on, it'll cheer us all up, said the MPs. And I was Squire Western, who's like that all the way through. Yep. And yeah, and farting and belching. And got the best write-ups of my life. And halfway through filming, these men turned up in dark blue suits and said, Brian, can we have a work? We're just going to have you break from filming Tom Jones. I was playing this wild character. We want you to go to Hong Kong. What? What are you talking about? What kind of clothes have you got? I said, well, I haven't got. I don't have. This is me at my best. This is me at my best. I never have any clothes. Well, we'll buy you two new suits, dark blue suits, and so forth. We'll give you £25,000, and we want you to be the narrator. Not, that's not the rater, what's the word? Master of Ceremonies. What? They wanted me to the Master of Ceremonies for the Hong Kong handover. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight you may not realize, I was the Master of Ceremonies for the Hong Kong handover. And I remember the first line. Today, ladies and gentlemen, the eyes of the world are upon us. Majesty, Miss Charles, etc., the President, and so forth. And it was like Zulu dawn. You know, we had the Army and the Navy and the Air Force there marching up and down, up and down. I mean, do you realize we may not have won the World Cup for a long time in football, but there's one thing we win all the time, and that's the military marching. We win the World Championship. We are the best. The Russians, when they march, it's a bit Putin, just a bit. The Americans exaggerate. Of course, the Germans, we know. But the English, we march precisely. The hand comes there, the hand comes there. And that night, it was raining a little bit, there was dancing going on, and on came the Army and the Navy and they fucking marched like you fucking wouldn't begin home at a second battalion. They marched up and fucking down, and when they did the slow bombs, they almost broke their hands. Boom! And you could see the Chinese premier looking on. Wish my men could march like that. What they were saying, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, etc., was, you may have Hong Kong, but that's as far as you go, you slit-eyed cunt. Don't take it any fucking further.
So when I edit the podcast...
He's fucking upstaging me again. I fucking knew he would. Anyway, so I was Marshal Assembly to the Hong Kong handover.
I'm going to jump in.
And then... Oh. Marshal Assembly to the Hong Kong handover. And then, on the northern side of Mount Everest, when I went to repeat the historic climb of George Lee Mallory with all my mountaineering friends, brilliant. We won all kinds of awards for Galahad of Everest. You see, in 1924, George Lee Mallory, to cut it short, George Lee Mallory and all the British climbers in 1921, 1922, and then in 1924, went for the summit of Everest in Norfolk jackets and puttees. And Mallory was last seen 200, 300, 400 feet from the summit, long before Hilary and Tenzing. And the mists came down, and he was never seen again. No doubt at all, as I said to you earlier, they're always rather refined about what happened to Mallory with 200, 300 feet to go. I would like to say categorically here, because I went up to those heights, he pissed it! Of course he fucking climbed it! The greatest mountaineer who's ever lived. Sir Galahad, as he was called. Galahad of Everest. And there was a world peace climb on the mountain with us, the Russians, the Americans, and I had a wonderful time. With the Chinese, having a wonderful time with them. But one of the Chinese was called Mr. Ping. Oh, he was a right little shit. And he was always pestering the BBC and all of us. We didn't have much money. For money from us and stealing from us and this, that, and the other. And the Americans hated him. And when I was at about 25,000 feet with the Americans and the Russians, they said, this Mr. Ping, I think we'll edge him into a crevasse. We're talking about life in the raw. I'm talking about life in the raw. I'm not talking about walking down here to go and see the latest production of South Pacific. I'm talking about life in the fucking raw. This guy was causing mayhem, Mr. Ping. And I heard them describe they were going to fucking do him in. And it was after months of this, and I took him alongside. He hated me.
Hello, Mr. Big Fat Mallory. Are you following Mr. Big Fat Mallory?
Mr. Ping, you must go down. You go down, Mr. Ping. Why? Oh, you won't live. Go down. I can't have your death on my... And he went down, the Chinese. And so at base camp many weeks later, he was very quiet. And I noticed that he liked the ice cream making machine of the Americans. What do they do with ice cream on Everest? I don't fucking know. What were they doing with fucking ice cream? And anyway, I noticed he was washing the ice cream making machine that the Americans had. I said, I think he wants it. Mr. Ping... would you like this machine? We don't use it much. And he took it. And from that day on, we had no trouble from him whatsoever. It's amazing finding out what people want that will make them happy. All he wanted was an ice cream machine. No diplomacy, no nothing, and that was it. They were great expeditions, sir. Absolutely marvellous. I would like to say that we of the BBC decided to make Galahad of Everest. It cost us a lot of money, but we had the best camera teams, we had the best mountaineers, we had David Bashirs and the Americans, and we had Russians with us, and this, that, and the other. To repeat Mallory's great climb up the northern part, Mallory. It was said by one of the great philosophers at the time, what happened to Mallory and Irving? And the head of the Royal Geographical Society, Longstaff, said, brothers till death and a wind-swept grave. Joy at the journey's ending. Ye have climbed to the great white veil. Heard ye the chant? Saw ye the grail? Mallory was Galahad. So when he touched the grail on the summit, he disappeared. And we don't know to this day whether he climbed it or not. I embrace mystery. And I hope they never finally prove it. It's nice to have some mystery in life. I'd like to say amongst many of them, by the way, when we were the British, Americans, and Russians, attempting Mallory's route, not to beat Mallory, we had better clothes, etc., but just to film the route. And I was nearly 60 years of age, beyond, and so forth. And I broke all the records on that. Fucking marvellous. You're looking at a fucking genius, love. To love oneself is to have a lifelong romance. And I do love myself. You've got to learn to fucking love yourself. When I wake up in the morning, I see my face. There I fucking... I think, I love you. I love it that I look like a fucking yeti. I love it that I look like a fucking gorilla. I love it that I can get on with these creatures. I want to say... I am also sick to fucking death of age. What's all these bollocks about being old and getting this and getting that? I mean, you watch the fucking television, all the fucking adverts. I've not been feeling too well, you know. I'm doing my flowers at the... Oh, I thought I brought this in. Oh, that's my pension scheme and that's what they said and the other, that they give me, you know. And this is a sensor. They test you and it doesn't cost much. And no awkward questions, like you've got galloping knob rot or whatever. No awkward questions. And she goes off in the advert and comes back. Oh, I did it. I took the scheme you told me. Oh, I feel so relieved. And you want to say, right, then we'll take you out in the back garden and fucking show you. I mean, they peddle death. They make us scared. They take the piss out of us. I won't accept it. I won't have it. I have great faith in poets and art and beauty. I love this country. I've been president of the national parks. President of the National Parks for 14 years. I created the South Downs. I put all the butterfly farms up and everything else. You're looking, I'm not rubbish, and so forth. But there it is. Nature doesn't cheat. There is no one like you. There is no one like you. We all have something that nobody else has got. You've got to be allowed the chance to use it. Be yourself. Go for it. And don't let the bastards grind you down. There is no one like you. But I want to say, I've just been saying to Kevin that I next wanted to make a film where I am now part of the space program. See, I'm 86. I'm not going to be put down. I'm not going to be retired. Retire on life? Never. No. Never. I love life too much. I know too much. I go for it. I need to protect the Earth as much as I possibly can. But I believe in the space program. In the 50s, we had Blue Streak, Black Arrow, Black Knight. We were going to the moon. And we stopped it all. We stopped it all. The government stopped it all. I'm not criticizing the government. They stopped it all. We're natural airmen. We're natural pilots. We're natural adventurers. There's a great space. And BBC decided to make a film in which I will get fully trained with Catherine d'Estavelle, the great climber Catherine d'Estavelle of France, and with lots of other American scientists and geologists. We would go to Reunion Island in the Pacific, and we would go to Russia, to Red Star, Star City, and be taught how to be cosmonauts and astronauts by NASA. And I've done that. I'm a fully trained cosmonaut. I'm a fully trained astronaut. I went there. We filmed in Moscow. I remember I was filming and I was telling an audience one day, and I was running up and down at one stage in the Mir in 1989, 1990. And you always get doubters. You always get people who want to put you down and say, that shows you're a fucking liar, Mr. Blessed, because Mir was vaporized 5 years before you said you were running up and down it. I say, can you not find a little bit of belief? Can you not work it out? Why? They built two. They built another for training. And we used it. The Russians were marvelous. Slavic and all of them, and etc. And I did complete space training. I am a complete, at 86, a completely fully trained cosmonaut. I did the centrifuge. I did another big fuge that was a great big one with big hands. I did all kinds of things, electrical equipment and this, that and the other. I was put through this, I put through that. I was put in MiG-25s upside down, MiG-29s upside down. You bet. I took on the challenge. And so did Catherine d'Estavelle. Wonderful. We completed our training. And I went then to Reunion Island in the Pacific with the Americans. The American who designed our suits. We pretended that we were going to go to Mars. It was to start the Martian program. And this man designed the Russian costume. And he is the man who designed the Predator in the film The Predator. Yeah. He designed the Predator. He's 7'8". And he designed the suits for us for Mars. And we succeeded. So I'm fully trained. I am now, at this moment, any time, liable to get a phone call. I've made friends in my little hut in the garden, which we all have our huts, don't we? Like James Barry. And Colin Pillinger, remembered at last, thank you, Louise. Colin Pillinger, I worked with him and so forth. On Beetle 2, and this, that, and the other. And so he died a short while ago. And so the phone would ring. My wife, it wasn't. Now and again, Ken Branagh would phone me. Well, I have a father-son relationship with Ken Branagh. I mean, I'm the son and he's the father. I mean, he's an old prick compared to me. I'm very, very young. He's probably out there, Ken. But anyway, I have this relationship with Ken. Is the only actor I really know. Patrick's way off in America, you know, making bees' eyes, by the way. And he's over there. But where was I? So anyway, there I'm a kind of fully trained cosmonaut, astronaut. We have great scientists in this country, up and down. So in my little hut and so forth, my wife, when the phone rings, she doesn't say, well, sometimes it's Ken Branagh, but it's not Michael Gambon, or it's not somebody else, or it's not some top actor, or anybody else, or Keanu Reeves or somebody. The phone rings over the last few years, and it would be Stephen Hawke, you know, the Time Man. Hello, Brian. This is Hawking here. They want to put me 60,000 feet in space. What do you think, Brian? Well, you're going to fucking die anyway. You might as well fucking go up anyway. Ha, 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 ha. Brian Blessed says I'm going to fucking die. I might as well go up. Of course, I don't believe in death. I'll make something clear. I use that relatively death. If there's one thing, there's only one thing in life that dies, it's death. No, we have always lived. You don't think what you know now you've learned in such a short space of time. You've been handed it over many, many repetitions and so forth. You're young. It's great to see the ladies emerging everywhere. I've always liked women. I love women. I've learned so much from them as a little boy. And it goes on and on and on. What a delight to see the wonderful ladies who are helping this planet. So I see a great future for us. As I've said, I am out of my mind because of the Webb telescope. I've written a chapter in my next book called Big Ears. It's about all the things that are listening. I've heard. We're getting replies back. We've had 60 replies back. And it goes, from Sagittarius and beyond. We're receiving messages. I passionately feel that we need help. Not depressingly, but we need to send out more SOSs. Save our soul. We need help. You can see most of the governments are absolute arse backwards tit, aren't they? Haven't a fucking clue in existence what they're fucking doing.
Brian, I'm going to have to interject, I'm afraid.
What are you going to
just want? Because of time, and I hate doing
Why?
It.
What time is it?
It's nearly time for the audience questions. Now, what I just want to say, and this is a compliment, what I love about you, and which is probably what everyone here loves about you, is that I have literally asked one question. I have.
You greedy fucker!
And I think you'll agree that we've kind of gone very much to places that I didn't think we were going to go. but I had two pages of subject matter here, and I know I've literally covered one line from the top, and I'm absolutely happy about that. I'm absolutely happy about it.
Before... No, you ask anything you fucking like.
Well, just before we move, because I'm going to skip Blackadder and Star Wars. You've mentioned Flash Gordon. I think if we don't get a bit more into Flash Gordon before the Q&A, people will be upset.
I've been talking about Flash Gordon and so forth, and this, that, and the other. I'd like to mention Blackadder in the fact that the original series started, would have been something called Blackadder. By the way, when the critics saw the first episode, they thought it was the worst shit that ever. the critics were in lining up saying how fucking awful it was, and so forth. I just like saying Blackadder. So would I be Richard the Fourth? Because we never existed. And I was Richard the Fourth on my horse, Alnwick Castle, and my son's drawn in front of, because I can't remember Blackadder's name, can I? I always call him Ethel or Enid or Mary or something. Who are you? Ethel? No, I don't know. Anyway, I was on my horseback in the first series, and we're going out to go and fight the Turks. We're setting off with my army. And I'm on my horseback in the first episode, first chapter, and my son comes forward, not Blackadder, the other one, Edward, I think it is. He comes forward, hello, Daddy, and so we're going now. Yes, well, don't forget to love your fellow man as yourself, unless he's Turkish, in which case, kill the bastards! Now, jump ahead. I climb Mount Ararat. And I climbed it with a Turkish platoon. It was about fucking 11 days, but we fucking got up. And they were lovely to me, and so forth. And thank fuck they don't know. Of course, you don't want to fight the Turks, because they have tanks out there you've never seen. They're tough fuckers. They're tough cookies. I got on the summit, and this platoon lifted me high, rejoicing. They liked me very much. And they went, there you are. Don't forget to love your fellow man as yourself, unless he's Turkish, in which case, kill the bastard. I thought, fuck me. They're going to use me for fucking bayonet practice. But they loved it. We loved Blackadder. We'd watch it all the time. You're always calling us the Turkish bastard and trying to kill us all the time. You know, it's one episode, I killed 50,000 of them with a penknife. You know, and my whole body's come oozing with blood. And I go, blood, 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 blood. Humpy, pumpy, humpy, pumpy is what I need now. After killing the Turks, he's humpy, pumpy, so he can fuck anything that moves. And next question.
Yes.
Yes. Poor kid. Kevin, you've done brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Do they look like my own teeth? No, it doesn't. Don't stupid
man. Let's finish. I am gonna. The image thing has gone to shit. Let's face it. That's fine.
It's gone to shit.
Yeah, it's gone to shit. But here we go. we've done a bit of that. Here we go. Yeah. Prince Fulton.
Flash Gordon.
Flash Gordon, I know you've talked it to death, but I know that you were a huge fan yourself. And in your book, again, you said to Mike Hodges, I'd walk 1,000,000 miles and eat 1,000 dinosaurs to play that part.
Yes.
You're not pulling my plonker, are you?
Yeah,
so
I did say that, yes.
Yes.
I did say.
So what was it about that role of Flash Gordon that you loved so much already?
Well, I'd seen it as a child in black and white. I thought the series in black and white was brilliant. We went to the two cinemas to see it. And Buster Crabbe, I thought, was sensational as Flash. Absolutely brilliant. In black and white, I loved the scenery. I loved the music. Litz's music. Vroom, boom, boom, boom. And the rocket ship's going around. Vroom, boom, boom, boom. Da-dum, da-da, da-da-da-da-dum, da-dum, dum-dum. And Ming was dangerous. His ray, I remember Louise, my manager, saying how frightening the ray was when it was going to kill Flash, burn his brain out with a ray. And it had tremendous kind of thing. And we'd seen Dick Barnes, Special Agent. We'd heard it. Paul Temple, The War of the Worlds, The Lost World. We'd seen all kinds of things. We'd seen Sabu in Jungle Book and everything else. But we had never seen. It was absolutely sensational. And Flash is the hardest part in the film. I thought the best part, for color, if you can get it right, and I didn't think the guy in Flash Gordon went far enough, and it was a guy playing Voltron. What I was very jealous was he had a fucking bear at one point. And I said, Gino, can I have a bear? No, Brad, it's too expensive. You'll only get killed. Somebody will get fucking killed. You mean Italian fucker, I said. He and I had a marvelous relationship, by the way. People were terrified of Dino Laurentiis, you know.
This is the producer.
Oh, no, he loved producer, director. A legend. You know, he would kind of march in the studio. People shook. They were so frightened. Dino! And I'd be flying with 2,500 men, you know, with wires around my bollocks. And I could hardly fucking speak. And I've been up there for 2 hours, and they're all shit scared and not getting their positions right. Dino, 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 we won't get this fucking done, and I can't feel my bollocks. Get off, you're frightening everyone. I'm going, Dino. The kid tells me to fuck off. No one ever told Dino to fuck off. But anyway, I'll jump the gun a bit. But the thing is that Buster Crabbe was sensational. I thought the black and white version was marvellous. I thought the clay men in the Marshall bit, the clay men and their language, of course, white's so brilliant in it, in the black and white version, the clay men, is that they're recorded speaking backwards. And that's... It's very effective. Very imaginative, the first series in black and white. And we all wanted to play it. I think the most difficult part in it, so I passionately wanted to be Voltron, but they just cut after one meeting. They cast me, and that was it. I went in the studio at Brooklands, and there was a big painting of me as Voltron. I said, "You've cast me, you rotten sods." "No, Brian," said Dino, "that's what he looks like." I said, "Well, it's me. I've never done a part that is me. I have never enjoyed a part so much. I raced to the studio to be in it. I just ran there, loved it. And, you know, Max von Sydow was a wonderful Ming. And he was about to walk on all in red. And they built me a perch because I had these wings. And when I couldn't sit down with these fucking wings on. So they built me a perch. You know, and all the camera crews and the dwarfs would shout, "Pretty Polly, pretty Polly, pretty." So we're all taking the fucking piss all the fucking way through it, you know. And the crews loved me. And they would say the most wonderfully inane, charismatic admiration statements and say, the second assistant would say, now, Dave, we're doing this shot now. Brian's making his entrance. Brian's making his entrance at the beginning. I would like to say, without any doubt at all, that Brian is the greatest fucking actor
who has ever fucking lived. Isn't that so, Brian? He can have a close-up as he walks in. I want the whole studio to be quiet. Is there anything you want, Brian? I say, get those fucking dwarfs out of my fucking eyeline! Because the dwarfs had a terrible time. Because they were sweating and in their armour and so forth. So then I had to just pull off their hats to see, hello, Curly! And R2-D2 was underneath, and all kinds of... I remember when Ming was dying at the end, he has the rocket through his stomach and all that green blood comes out, you know, pouring up. And it was a Friday afternoon, you know, and I was sat there with my wings and I got all the 11 dwarfs alongside me with their hats off and we're looking at Ming the Merciless with the fucking rocket through his stomach and blood, green blood coming out of his body. And we go, because there was no sound on it. And we go, ooh, that must be painful.
Yes, it must be painful. Are you in pain, Mr. Ming? Are you in pain?
And he's trying to act it, and all he can hear is, ooh, look at that, he's suffering. That lad's suffering. And right cut, and he went, you fucking morons. He chased us round the fucking studio. But in his opening scene, the beginning of his entrance in Flash Gordon, he came up to me. I was always flattered. He always consulted me, of course. And he said, Brian, I quite honestly don't know how to play it. I don't know how to play the part, and I'm just about to come on, all in red, as you did that wonderful entrance. I said, well, it's quite simple, Max. I saw you... in the Quiller Memorandum with George Siegel, and you tortured him and other people, and you kept breaking your fingers. Can you use this when you act? I said, and it was very threatening that you were going to break his neck and so forth, politely break his neck. I said, and he is a magician, so he uses his hands. He's also incredibly sexy. He has sexual scenes, you know, where he's love potions. So he's always there. So you're sinuous and sexy and power. The power is in your fingers.
Thank you very much, Brian.
And I gave him the notes on how to play it. And, of course, he did it quite wonderfully. It's a wonderful, wonderful performance. But in all the things, like melody is terribly good. When you see the film again, ladies and gentlemen, like when Melody, as Dale, comes into my palace, she thinks she's free. She thinks she's going to be all right. But I am an agent of Ming. I'm a reluctant hero. I don't give my fighting squadrons to Ming. I'm forced into it because of Flash. And she's now a prisoner in my wonderful set, that Sky City. She walks on and so forth, right? And she's talking to Zarkov, and Zarkov says, there, go for it. You must go for it. You must go for it. You must try. You must work with Flash and this, that, and the other. You must fight the Imperial Fleet. And I say, fight the Imperial Fleet? We cannot fight the Imperial Fleet. As I'm walking past, I ran my hand up Dale's arse. Because I have got concubines and God, I've got rows and rows and rows of maidens who are my girlfriends. And I want her as one of my girlfriends. So she's still under threat. I said, we must maintain threat. So as I walk back, what are you saying, Zarkov? What, fight me? Fight the Imperial Fleet? And then I continue talking. Right, do a very quick goose. Fight the Imperial Fleet! And then continue talking. Just to show she's still under threat. So every second in the film is worked out. But what I've not mentioned, ladies and gentlemen, is that the most difficult part, anybody who tells you in this acting profession
that the villains are the best parts. I will tell you now, I think that is absolute codswallop. The best parts are the heroes, and they're the most difficult parts. And Sam Jones, you see, to cast Flash is very difficult. Sam Jones is perfection. I see him a lot now these days. I'm doing things with him. We are actually possibly going to do a second film going to Mars. And they can make me look young and all that, you know. You didn't say I look young, did you? No, don't fuck about
that. I was thinking they don't need to.
Your queue, you fuck the queue up anyway. What I'm saying is, that Flash is incredibly difficult part. Now, if you cast Flash, if you had Tom Cruise, a favorite actor of mine, or Keanu Reeves, or any of them, you put them on camera, the camera can move in a certain direction, and they will look sinister. Tom Cruise cannot look totally, 100% sweet, lovely. He has a slight sinister touch to his, which gives him personality. Why not? But all the young actors, all the stars, men, they all have an idiosyncrasy which makes them slightly sinister. Sam Jones, you could put him anywhere, put the camera on him anywhere, and he is pure. He is absolutely lovely and pure. I came in one day and filming had stopped. And Dino said, we can't film. Flash won't film. That Sam Jones won't film. I thought he won't film. All he has to do is just one shot. He appears behind the guard and then he knocks the guard out. And he won't do it. What's this, Sam? Is it Brian. Flash Gordon would never appear behind somebody and hit them. So I said, right. Well, it's quite simple. Just go, then he can turn round, then you can hit him. So you go, then you can hit him. Because he turned round and he's looking at you. Now you can hit him. And I save the day. Aren't I fucking mad? But
right, I must interject one more time just because of time. We're going to get some questions from the audience, otherwise they're going to moan at me. We have about 10 minutes, just so you know, for time.
Is that for the whole lot?
Yeah.
What, for the whole show?
No, for the whole Q&A. Right. Go.
Brian,
speak quickly.
Yep. One of the greatest scenes in I, Claudius is Augustus's death scene. What are your memories of filming that scene?
Yeah, where are you from, my old son?
Glasgow.
Yeah, from Glasgow. Do you support Celtic or Rangers?
Neither. I hate fucking football.
By the way, I'm an honorary Wallace. Did you know that? Is that good? I'm an honorary Wallace. We did Chasing the Deer, the film, and I played. I arranged all the battle scenes and all that. And so the Wallace has made me an honorary Wallace. Anyway, I'll tell you about my death scene. Ladies and gentlemen, as there's no end to my talents, I was very popular in, I think that, it's very interesting that I was in Z-Cars, as I've mentioned. And I was a tough guy in it, with a great Yorkshire accent. And the director was Herbie Wise. And Derby Wise was considered at the BBC to be the best director the BBC has ever produced. You know, he'd done Elizabeth R. You know, he'd done with Glenda Jackson. He'd done Forsyte Saga, all kinds of things he'd done. And he was now going to do I, Claudius. Now, when I was in Z-Cars, he directed a great many of them. He won many awards, Herbie Wise. He was a short little man, broad, but was frightened the life out of actors. He was a tremendous disciplinarian, a brilliant mind. And he distinctly disliked me. He thought that my part in Z-Cars was too fierce, too strong, and too threatening. I got millions of letters from ladies. So I was loved, but not Herbie. He said, no,
He did that a lot. He's too strong. I don't like it. It's unnecessary. All the scripts, it's always powerful. He always knocks the man out. He's always did. I don't like it. He's frightening at times, which wasn't true. I was just very tough. My mate, Jock, in the car was very gentle. There's a lovely balance. Colin Welland in the other car with Jimmy Ellis, gentle and tough. But I was the ultimate tough guy and knocked everybody out, flattened, and saved children all the time. I was always saving children. But great scripts I received, and all the directors wanted to direct to me. Sean Sutton, in particular, wanted the great Doyen of the BBC, wanted to direct me as Flash, Fancy Smith. But Herbie couldn't take it, and so forth. This is a long story. I'll make it as short as I can. No one was ever late for Herbie Wise. No one dare be late for him, not for a second. Now, we had in our company what I would say roughly was our leading man, Strafford Johns, playing the inspector. He was the one who was the big brain, and so forth. And he was delighted he'd become a big star. You know, he was 50 years of age, etc. And he was 1 minute late, the most, for a rehearsal in the afternoon with Herbie Wise. Now, he's in the press all the time. He owned a hotel. He was a big, big noise, Strafford Johns. And he came in and Herbie went, Where have you been? Doing publicity for the Radio Times. I've been doing this, he said. I've been doing that. You're a minute late. Well, don't let it happen again. It was Herbie. Anyway, he was directing me in one of my... I got the biggest part in the next episode. Playing a tough guy, as always. Knocking the shit out of somebody who kidnapped some children and rescuing them and so forth. Now, as an actor, I have to tell you, this is leading up to your... to I, Claudius. As an actor, I have always at times, and I recommend this to people, that you don't have to always be doing your job every day of the week. I now and again go on a walkabout. I still do. I mean, that's why I climb mountains. That's why I do my space. I'm not like other actors generally. I tend to want to get out there on my own and fuck off. And I do what, you know, I do what the Maoris do, you know, etc. I go on a walkabout. And I go on a walkabout. I didn't want to fucking act. I want to go onto the river in Richmond, get on a fucking rowing boat, and row all fucking day. That you want to act every day of your life? Every day of your life? Somehow it's not healthy. And I fucked off. On Herbie's episode, in rehearsal. I fucked off! Fucking fellow. And Herbie went off his head. He went off his head. He said to Frank Winter, he said to the inspector, Abala, and all the kid, and all the rest of the car, where is he? Where is he? We're fucking 3 hours late. He's got all the fucking lines. Where is that fucking bum? I can't stand him. I hate the way he plays his fucking bike, too tough. And now, where is he? We can't film. We can't do this. We can't fucking rehearse. I will fucking skin him fucking alive when he appears. When he comes, I'll fucking skin him fucking alive. Calm down, Herbie. Keeps my production late. It's going to be 5-6 hours. When he comes in, just a fucking trouble. I'm funny up, Director General Hugh Weldon. I'm going to get him sacked. I'm getting fucking sacked. They said, we promise you, Herbie, please calm down, they all said. Strafford Johnson, all of them, Jock and everyone, calm down. We promise you that when Brian walks in, you won't say a fucking word. And of course, after about 5 hours, I fucking turn up. And I raced in and I said, Herbie, my mother's dead. My mother just fucking been killed in a fucking car crash. And they put her in fucking hospital. My dad's looking after his dog because she had to rush across her fucking knees. And he's had a fucking heart attack. He's fucking dead. chasing me. He's gonna have a fucking heart attack. He's dying. My mother's dead. I'm underacting it. And Herbie stood there like this. And Frank Windsor said, "There you are, you see. We told you wouldn't better say anything." "Right. I'm so sorry, Brian, about your mother and your father. I'll just rest you with a cup of tea and we'll mark out the rest of the script. Sorry about that, Brian." Everybody's pissing themselves with fucking laughter. Herbie can't say a fucking word and everyone's showing sympathy towards me. Oh, anyway. This is your answer, right? Herbie Wise. Then suddenly the phone rang and Hildegard Neal, our manager Hildegard Neal, the actress, played Cleopatra to Charlton Heston. The man who haunted himself, playing Roger Moore's wife. That's my wife. And she's been rather ill, actually. She's getting over it wonderfully. We've got lots of animals, and we have a wonderful, happy life. Anyway, where was I? So they phoned my agent up, and my agent phoned me up, John, and he said that they're doing I, Claudius. It's going to be the big blockbuster of television, is the biggest thing over on the BBC. All-star cast, they've got Sean Phillips, they've got George Baker, they've got John Hurt, they've got Derek Jacobi, they've got Patrick Stewart, they've got, we went through 20 people. Well, they want you to play Augustus Caesar. They want you to, he's the lead. For the first 7 episodes, every inch of it is, he is the emperor. Augustus Caesar. This is after being Francis Smith for you. Oh, who's directing? Is it Herbert Wise? Yes, you're taking the piss. Herbie would never fucking tolerate working with me again, and so forth. No, they're offering you Augustus Caesar. And the press said, "Well, wonderful cast you've got there." Said the press, "Click, click, 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 click. But we don't understand why you cast Brian Blessed as Augustus Caesar." He said, "Because no one can shoot shit like Brian." And he's right. He was right. And that's what Augustus is like. Brilliant brain. And cons and cons. How do you handle all our politicians at the moment? He would have eaten them alive. He was amazing. He would have eaten them alive, love. A brilliant brain. We had a wonderful time. Herbie and I loved one another. And we got on marvellously and so forth. It was a sensational experience. And then I came to rehearsal one day at White City and virtually, I'm delighted to say, the cast were weeping because I was going to die as Augustus. I've become 90 years of age. His history is amazing. He beat Mark Antony, he beat all the European armies and all the Eastern armies. He won everything, the great Augustus. And of course, my wife poisons me and I'm dying. A slow scene where I'm going to die. And everyone in rehearsal were depressed. I was very flattered and moved. Oh, Christ, we're going to lose Brian. Rehearsals won't be the same. Because I did outrageous things as Augustus. Quite outrageous, you know. I mean, things like you can imagine. George Baker. "You ain't seeing your ex-wife! Don't even know! Don't know it! I destroyed the whole of the Byzantine Empire! I'll destroy you just like that! Seeing your wife, you make my family look ridiculous! Shut up! Don't sulk." I mean, it's kind of, I remember some of the fucking lines I got. "I killed 25 senators in one scene who have slept with my daughter." "Have you slept with my daughter? Have you? Oh, not slept. Standing up, sitting down. And
Now I'm going to die. And Herbie Wise said, we're so upset. But Brian, I'm going to give you your hardest acting role. No. I want to see Rome die. You are Rome. I'm going to put the camera close on your face. And I'm going to watch you die of poisoning. Sian's got 20 lines in 20 pages. We won't see her. We'll hear her talk. It's just going to be on your face. And at the beginning of the take, it'll take 5 to 6 minutes. You'll be dead. And I'm going to have the camera on your face of you dead for 5, 6 minutes. If you see people in films who are dying, they're dead in 7 seconds. They're given 3 or 5. You watch them. How long has it been dead? So take his pulse. 1, 2, 3. Off the camera. Off. You know, they don't keep the camera on people. They can't do it. They can't. They're blinking. Or this moves, or that moves. I say, 6 minutes. I want the camera close on your face. You can do it. You can do it. And then I will see Rome die like it's never been done. Did I succeed?
We've run out of time now. Technically, there was an audience Q&A. We have run out of time. Thank you very much for coming tonight. I'm very grateful. I know that Brian will
be. Are they all coming back?
Are they coming back?
Yeah, no. What's happening now?
We're finished.
What, for the whole show?
We have finished.
What, for the whole evening? Fuck it. I'll tell you what. I can't end it on some prick dying. No, thanks for mentioning. I want to say my best friend is a father-son relationship is Kenneth Branagh. We have a great, deep relationship, Ken, and so forth. I have the reputation of not being frightened of anything, and I'm not. And only a few years ago, I was asked to be Pavarotti in Stars in Their Eyes for about 50,000 quid, you know, for charity. I said, no, fucking no. Don't forget, I was in Cats, the musical. And many other musicals. And so I said, no, Pavarotti. And then I told Ken, he said, no, you're scared, aren't you? I said, I'm not fucking scared. I'm not scared of any fucking thing. But when I was in Cats, one evening, we had Pavarotti there, we had Domingo there, we had Carreras there, and they were all of them calling him Maestro. I said, why to Carreras? Why to Domingo? Why do you call him Maestro? Because he is superior. Domingo said to me, my voice is fruity. I am fruity. I am a fruity singer. Carreras is foggy, aren't you? Yes, I am foggy. The Stefano is too sharp. But Pavarotti is perfection. It is perfect. In every way, his voice is perfect. No one else can imitate it. That's why I've said no. Ken said, I still feel this is something in your nose. So I said, then they offered 100,000. 200,000. You get to 450,000 quid for charity. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. The makeup, if you saw it, was sensational. I don't look unlike it. They blackened my hair. They blackened my beard, made it fuller. They filled me with lots of padding. I mean, I'm 17. I'm 18. Shut your face. I'm 18 stone, etc. But they made me 20, 24, 25 stone. And they made me stand there, you know. And, of course, I went off as Brian Blessed, and then the mist came down, and then I walked back in again, and I was in a black outfit, and I looked up, I could see Pavarotti watching. Oh, Christ, he's here. And then I did that, and I realised it was me. It wasn't Pavarotti, it was me. I remember stepping forward, I remember kind of handkerchief.
Monticello, chi è bello in me, oh, solo mio, stand from tear te, oh, sole, oh, sole mio.
Brian Blessed, thank you so much. They're your glasses. Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Blessed, everyone. Thank you very much.
Gordon's alive.